I did not prepare a talk for tonight, partly because of last Monday night's talk. Those of you who were here, I was wondering if you had any follow-up you wanted to do in that talk. That talk could be seen as being controversial. It could be seen as being subversive. It could be seen as being a great challenge, and by our guest speaker last week. And I thought maybe some of you would like to follow up and some discussion about that, your reactions to it and whatever. Or if there is no reactions or discussion to be had about it, then we can just take tonight as kind of an open forum to have Dharma questions you have about your practice. We don't do that often on Monday nights, and I think it's very helpful to hear where people are at in their practice and questions they might have. Is the speaker working okay? Everybody's hearing? Is the light okay? People happy with the temperature? So, does anyone have any questions from last week or concerns, or would you like a summary?
Summary would be good.
Yeah. People who were here last week want a summary?
Yeah.
And why was it an important talk? Okay. So the guest last week, Tan Jeff or Tanisiro Bhikkhu, is unusual in various ways. And one of the unusual things he brings to American Buddhism is he's an abbot of a Thai forest monastery in San Diego County. So he's definitely a player of the developing Buddhism in the West. But one of the unique features of him is that when he was a relatively young man, he was introduced to enough Buddhism at Oberlin College, where he went to school, that he went to Thailand. At first he taught English in Chiang Mai for a couple of years, and then he became ordained as a Theravadan monk. I think he was ordained for a year, and then he disrobed and came back to America for a short while, and then went back to Thailand, reordained, and then stayed ordained since about 1976 or 77, something like that. And a lot happened in American Buddhism between 1976 and 1975, and the time he came back again, about 1990 or so. And it was a very fertile time for the development of especially the Theravadan branch of Buddhism in the West. People like Jack Kornfield, Joseph Goldstein, Sharon Salzberg in particular, had studied in Asia Theravadan Buddhism, the Vipassana practice, and they had brought it back to America and in a sense repackaged it from the way it was introduced to them in Asia and began teaching the Dharma in Western idiom, in Western ways, trying to make sense of it for Westerners, a Western audience. And they adapted various teachings. Some teachings they left behind, they didn't think Westerners wanted to hear because they didn't want to turn people, they felt the practice was really powerful, and they didn't want to turn people off by telling them about the Buddhist hell realms and how you're going to be reborn there if you step on an ant. And it's not that there's a lot of fire and brimstone kind of Dharma talks in Asia, but there are some, right? We have our Sri Lankan here who remember from your childhood fire and brimstone kind of Buddhist hell kind of. So when's the last time I talked about Buddhist hells and that you would get reborn there if you stepped on the ant? Not so often. So there were a number. I'm just kind of making fun of this now, but there are certain kinds of teachings which didn't make the mindfulness practice so inviting for Westerners, so they were kind of left behind or kind of not talked about very much. Certain teachings which really spoke to Westerners a lot were highlighted in the West so that they had greater importance for us. So that's what made it interesting for us. And certain things in Buddhism might have been misunderstood and kind of evolved or changed or transformed in the transmission to America. And certain things which are presented as Buddhist could be, anybody can say they're Buddhist, and who's to say they're not. But they're quite different from what the Asian tradition is. And sometimes this appropriation of Buddhism to American culture involves seeing ourselves. We really love Buddhism because Buddhism, sometimes Western Buddhism, is just a mirror of our own interests, our own worldview. And so that's part of the reason why Westerners like Buddhism so much. And one of the best-selling books on, I think the best-selling book on Buddhism in the West is a book called What the Buddha Taught. Who's read that in this room? What the Buddha Taught. And most people who read it in the West are quite inspired by that book. How many of you who raised your hand were inspired by that book? Some of you. And you know, people, what the Buddha taught. This is the teachings of the Buddha, and you know, the direct teaching, the direct transmission. This is how it really is. And it's been, and that book has been very popular in the West. It's sometimes a textbook in college classrooms and Introduction to Buddhism. But while Pula Rahula, who wrote the book, he was educated in the Sorbonne. He was a Sri Lankan who was deeply educated. He certainly studied Buddhism in Sri Lanka, but he also studied Buddhism in the West at Sorbonne and probably at Oxford and different places in the West. And his understanding of what Buddhism is was very much influenced by his contact with the West and Western philosophers and Western Buddhist scholars who were trying to make sense out of Buddhism. So when he wrote What the Buddha Taught, he was writing the kind of Buddhism he thought would work for Westerners. And so, of course, then it worked for Westerners. Westerners saw themselves in that book, in a sense. They didn't recognize themselves, but so they really loved the book. Am I making some sense to you? So there's a way in which we sometimes appropriate Buddhism, understand Buddhism in our own terms, because we have certain categories of understanding reality, worldview, frames of references. That's how we see reality, how we want to organize it. And then we look at Buddhism, which comes from a very different culture, very different cultural background, and we either pick those pieces that work for us, or we actually see things anew that maybe weren't there originally, but kind of seem to be there. We kind of interpret it there, and then we create a kind of new Buddhism for in the West, and it really works for us because we've invented it. I think I'm driving this home. Kind of, it's not as dire as it sounds, I hope, but it's a little bit like that. So Tan Jeff, the monk who was here last week, his Buddhism that he studied was almost entirely studied in Asia, in Thailand, in a very traditional Thai Buddhist setting. He learned Thai, became fluent in Thai. He entered very deeply into the world of the Thai forest tradition and really got to know it really, really well. In a way that people like Jack and Joseph didn't, because they kind of came and went a lot. They weren't there for 15, 20 years. They were there for a lot shorter period of time. And he wasn't here in America as Buddhism was kind of being formulated and interpreted for the Westerners. He wasn't even interested in Western interpretations. He was there trying to absorb a very traditional teachings of what Buddhism is in the Thai forest tradition. So when he came back to America in the 1990s, because he was so deeply steeped in a different kind of Buddhism, he could see much more clearly than we can who are living in our culture those parts of Buddhism that we had kind of transformed in the American setting. And those parts of Buddhism which we hadn't. Because when we're in the middle of it, we can't often see what we've done. I remember, you know, some of you know the little book that I helped edit called Teachings of the Buddha. And it's a nice little anthology of a few inspirational teachings of the Buddha and later Buddhist teachers down through the ages. Someone came to me with that book once in their hand and said, is this all the Buddha taught? And the almost symbolic meaning of that for me was that this person had taken this book that we had edited, and which edited means that we had selected those things which we were inspiring for us and we thought were inspiring for you all, Westerners, and taken this to be the definitive work of the Buddha's teaching. So I hope many of you don't think that. I hope you enjoy the book, but not take it to be, you know, this is all there is. So that makes Tan Jeff a little bit unusual and worth listening to because he has this very different perspective to understand what's happening in American Buddhism. Because he's a Westerner who can read all our books. You know, with Asian teachers often can't. And he's interested in doing that, in studying, reading those books. And he has this very different vantage point from understanding it. So he can pick out those things that seems a little bit odd to me. You know, where'd that come from? I never heard that in Thailand, or I never read that in the suttas. Oh. And he's a scholar, in part, and one of the things he is. And so he's... and then he was pulled into editing a college textbook on Buddhism. And the last chapter had to do with Buddhism in America. So he started studying much more carefully so he can write this college textbook chapter. And he got very interested in some of the American Buddhist teachings, where do they come from? What's the origins? What are the influences that fed into them? And that was a talk last week where he was arguing that one of the important Western influences on the teachings of Buddhism in America is the European Romantic period, the Romanticism of European, the 1700s, 1800s. And how does that work? And his argument is some of the basic assumptions we have of what the religious life is, and what we expect out of the religious life, how we see it and how we understand it, and therefore how we appropriate Buddhism, comes kind of indirectly from the idea of what religion is that was first kind of expressed by the Romantics. So, is this okay? I'm going on and on. I don't want to give the whole talk over again. So the Enlightenment period in Europe was a time of science, the kind of explosion of science, scientific method, and there was, to say the least, a big questioning of the earlier framework for understanding reality, which had been the religious one. Both in Europe, it was primarily Jewish and Christian. And so the whole Jewish and Christian way of understanding reality was questioned and sometimes criticized and sometimes seen as being inadequate. And scientific method was seen as being the great hope for progress and the great alternative to this sloppy thinking of religion. And that the faith and religious experiences were really of much lesser importance than the kind of knowledge you can get from the scientific method. So that went on for a little while, and the Romantics came along and said a similar thing, where they said that religion is a matter has to do with feeling, which is part of what the Enlightenment critics of religion said, just the feeling. So, you know, the Romantics said the same thing. Religion has to do with feeling, not about knowledge and understanding. It was very hard to argue anymore that religion was going to give you a valid information and knowledge about the nature of reality. Because the Bible just didn't hold up for a lot of these people. But they didn't want it to denigrate religion. They wanted to say religion still has a place, and has a place higher, more important than science. And they said, yes, religion does have to do with human feeling, but human feeling is more important than knowledge. And what religious life is about is cultivating or developing certain feelings about nature, about reality, about oneself, about God. And the feeling relationship you had to God was more important than what you knew about God. And Tanjeff said then that this is also a very important strand of one of the most influential Protestant religions in America in the 1800s, which was Methodism. And Methodism also said that it's all about the method by which you have this feeling of a connection with God. The knowledge you have about God and how he works, or the knowledge of the world, is really secondary to establishing this piety, this pious feeling that you're going to have with the deity. And so the focus was on feeling, the feeling you have, the feeling of, and the particular kinds of feelings were important. A feeling of being connected, a feeling of being whole, a feeling of being interconnected to things, feeling of being intimate with the world and yourself, feeling of being whole inside, you become no longer fragmented, different, all these kind of fragmented parts of the psyche were no longer fragmented, and you became whole inside. Your psyche became whole again. It was a very important then part of this romantic movement. This then influenced the next kind of layer that build the foundation for us. And there were people like William James, Tanjev said, Carl Jung, and Abraham Maslow. And Carl Jung particularly was very much influenced by the Romantics. William James also. William James also put emphasis on feeling as being the important thing about religion. And he studied many different religious experiences and talked about the feeling and how they influence people. William James said that it's not the how you interpret the religious experience which is important, because different religious people having very similar experiences, but they interpret it differently. The interpretations are optional, but the experiences are important in and of themselves. So the focus became, again, like the Romantics, on the nature of the experience, not the knowledge or the interpretation that came out of the experience. So let's have an experience. Experience is what's important. Abraham Maslow also, experience is what's important, these peak experiences. And Carl Jung, very much this idea of integrating the self. There's these fractured parts of the self, there's a shadow part of the self, and to become whole, you have to somehow integrate it all to become whole. And that part of this integration then is a feeling of wholeness with the universe, with the cosmos, and a sense of interconnectedness. So, and then you come to the modern American convert Buddhism, the Buddhism of white, mostly European Americans, for the most part, which is, you know, makes it, whatever, that's, you know, that's a whole topic in itself. And what you find in the writings of some of these people, like, is a common kind of discussion about what Buddhism is. I'm still talking in for Tanjev here. You find people like Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldstein, Sheryl Salzberg, Joko Beck, Pema Chodron, Surya Das, kind of the big figures in American Buddhism from very different Buddhist traditions in Asia, giving a very similar kind of teaching about what Buddhism is for us in the West. And in the eyes of Tanjev, these teachers are almost interchangeable in the kind of way they present Buddhism, because they're kind of in the same milieu of kind of, they're influencing each other for sure, they read each other's books, and they're kind of contributing to this invention of American Buddhism. And one of the things that Tanjev wants to say is that what's common, one of the things that's common in these teachers is they describe the kind of goal of the religious life very much in terms of becoming interconnected, becoming whole, having a sense of oneness. So Jack Kornfield, for example, talks about there's a smaller self, which is a problem, and you want to realize that there's no separate self, which the Buddha never taught to use the word no separate self, because that implies that there's still a kind of a self, the non-separate self, when you deny there's a separate self. And then Jack will go on and say, well, the point of the practice is to like kind of transcend the small self and have some experience of the big self, where we all feel interconnected. And Joseph and all these teachers have this kind of flavor in their teaching. And in Tanjev's ears, this is a lot in common with what the Romantics and this lineage were teaching. And in fact, scholars of religion will point out that this is actually very common themes in the modern development of religion in America in general, not just in American Buddhism. Emphasis on the themes of interconnectedness and wholeness and oneness with things and feeling and experience and all this. And so what Tanjev says is this is a little bit, so we're understanding Buddhism through these romantic glasses, the glasses of the romanticism and all these people. And so of course we love it because it's in our Western tradition. That's what kind of, we were kind of growing up in it. And then he made this very provocative thing of saying that the teachings of interconnectedness, which is really strong in American Buddhism. I asked Joseph Goldstein once, said it's a little bit unusual to have such a strong emphasis on interconnectedness in Buddhism. And when did this enter into, where did it first appear in American Buddhism? And he thought about it for a while. He said, well, I think it entered the scene with Thich Nhat Hanh. That he has all sense of interbeing, which partly is because, partly it's out of his own particular Mahayana tradition that he does that, but it's also partly because of his political agenda, kind of the way he sees the world, his engaged Buddhism. Interconnectedness works really well for that. And we love interconnectedness, a lot of American Buddhists, partly because it's a really important, the world has become so interconnected now. And many of us have very strong environmental ethic, and the teachings of interconnectedness lend itself to a certain kind of, to the ethics of environmental engagement in the world. It lends itself to an ethic of engagement in the political realm in the world, the social service realm in the world, when the world has become like a village and we all feel so interconnected. It's a very powerful teaching because part of our life is phenomenally interconnected. And so it speaks to that part of the Western, modern Western psyche, which is really appreciating this interconnectedness. And so to give it kind of ultimate status by enshrining it in Buddhism, by saying the goal of Buddhism is to have this feeling of interconnectedness, of being interconnected, feels really good to us. And what Tanjeff said also is that part of the romantic notion and other people, or this strata of influence he was talking about, is that that things feel good become the validation for their truth. So interconnectedness, you know, have a feeling of interconnectedness and it feels good. Therefore it must be true, it must be right. And is just feeling good the right criteria for measuring what religious life is like or what's possible? So one of the more challenging things he said to was that in his study of the Buddhist history, and I think he's only using one data for his evidence, but he said it more broadly, is the teaching of interconnectedness was became an issue in Buddhism when Buddhism was being practiced or taught by the wealthy. And most of these interconnected American Buddhists, as a sociological group, come from a group of demographically of people who are, you know, relatively well-to-do. They tend to be middle class. They come from middle class background. Some people report that their contact with Buddhism has made them downwardly mobile. But you know, their background maybe is this kind of more privileged parts of society, the European American. For the most part, I mean, there's a lot of exceptions, of course. And so this teaching of interconnectedness, you know, maybe has something to do with the, you know, economic status of a group. And he said someone who's really poor and struggling for existence is not going to be celebrating interconnectedness, what he said. So, you know, it was a very challenging talk last week, I think, and very challenging to some of the basic notions we have about what we're doing here in the West and our teachings here in the West and our practice, and maybe for you. And it could be seen certainly as a challenge. It could be seen as subversive, what he was doing. It could have, in many ways, you could have interpreted last week. Some of you might have despaired upon hearing that talk. Some of you didn't even come back. It's multiple, there's fewer people today than last week. And a breath of fresh air. Yes.
What did he say he thought the point of Buddhism was, the goal of practice was?
So the question is, what did he say was the point of Buddhism?
There wasn't interconnectedness.
If there wasn't interconnectedness. So I don't remember that he actually said that last week in his talk, did he?
Yes. Yes.
He did, okay, someone fill me in.
The end of suffering.
The end of suffering.
Yeah, that was it. Basically, when the Buddha was asked point blank, what is your teaching? I'd say teach one thing alone, suffering and the end of suffering.
Mm-hmm. So one of the reasons why Tanjeff's talk is useful, I think, is the degree to which our minds fixate or settle or get attached to viewpoints as being the, you know, the point of our life or the meaning of our life or the what we think religious life is all about. And if Buddhist practice is really going to, you know, be up to the task of really uprooting suffering completely, it's really helpful to have the rug pulled from under the viewpoints that we use kind of to hold ourselves, support ourselves. So that if we're attached to those viewpoints, we can somehow be liberated from them and go all the way. Because certain viewpoints that can seem very enlightened are still viewpoints that get in the way of us becoming free. So that's why one of the reasons why I talked like last week can be very helpful. And in the Zen tradition, they kind of specialize in pulling the rug from underneath all our views. And that's part of the power of the Zen tradition. Smita.
I just wondered if Buddha had actually emphasized interconnectedness, how successful he would have been in the Indian subcontinent. That's where it was originated, because there's a very rigid caste system and a strong sense of pollution and people not touching each other.
Interconnectedness there meant...
Well, I don't think we're very popular.
Yeah, because we're too connected. If you get too connected to someone of the wrong caste, you get polluted.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I don't think any religion really ever operates in a cultural vacuum.
Right.
Know? And seems to me it works for you.
Yeah. So, I mean, one way of looking at Western Buddhism is that it's the appropriate medicine for this culture. That's one interpretation. But I think Maria had her hand up.
One of the things I found interesting is that there seems to be a confusion between philosophical viewpoint and how people approach Buddhism. That is, they don't have to be the same. The fact that we come from a particular philosophical perspective does not mean that we're necessarily distorting Buddhism, which
right.
I think is the implication of his talk. And one of the... I was very... stimulated by that talk, actually, and I thought a lot about these issues. And one of the things that it seems clear to me is that I personally have not approached Buddhism as a source of interconnectedness. I have a sense about interconnectedness that has to do with my philosophical framework, but it does not derive from Buddhism, and I can't really measure how much it influences what I feel about Buddhism or what I think about Buddhism or how I experience Buddhism. But I think that he detected that there's a lot of philosophical thinking that becomes interconnected, it gets blended with Buddhism
right.
in the West. But it was unclear to me what his point was as far as how it distorted Buddhism for us, because I don't think that's what Buddhism means, interconnectedness.
But there are people who take that. You read some of these books, and they specifically say that's what it's all about.
Well, of course,
you don't read those books.
No, I've read those books, but it doesn't mean that I adopt that point of view.
Yeah. Well, he'd be very happy if he heard that.
I think that's the point. Is that I think there is a tendency when you get something that affects how you look at your inner being. To relate it to philosophical and psychological concepts, which you may also be dealing with.
Right.
And to the extent that they blend, then, somehow you have to integrate yourself as a person. And I'm sure that that exists. I know that that exists. Certainly, I've dealt with the same issues together. But it does not necessarily mean that, that Buddhism is somehow polluted by that point of view.
Right. If you distinguish practice from philosophy, and then the practice is not interrupted by the philosophy,
right.
then there's not a problem, because the practice will just take you all the way to the goal. I don't know, so many hands.
It seems to me that implicit in what you're saying, or the explicit, was that the Southeast Asian tradition was the real Buddhism, and we had something here in America that was a deviation or variation. I don't accept that viewpoint. I think historically, Buddhism, by the time it started in India, by the time hundreds of years later went to China, it had changed. And China had to accommodate to Chinese culture and change. Then it went from there to Japan. But Zen Buddhism, was that inauthentic? Then it went from there to Southeast Asia. So even by the time it got to Thailand, it had gone through several countries and lots of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
Comes here and it's evolving and it's different. Here, maybe, it's just as good as there. Creating, it's as good as we're able to understand and practice and teach it.
That's a beautiful kind of ecumenical, very accepting view of all the different schools of Buddhism. Now, would a Southern Baptist in Florida look on Mormonism as, you know, it's all Christianity and it's all equally valid?
Mormonism is not considered Christianity.
By who?
By
Mormons?
It's understood by all other Christian churches.
But the Mormons, don't they consider them Christian?
No. Yes.
They don't? So what do we do with the Buddhist Mormon, the equivalents in Buddhism of the Mormons, you know? What do we do with them?
Well, I'm not an expert on Mormonism. Except for a few facts like that, Christian churches, Protestants, and Catholics, and so on, do not consider it a Christian.
Church of Jesus Christ and the Latter-day Saints, I think they consider themselves
But who's going to decide that? I mean, it's the same thing in Buddhism. There's some phenomenal religions within Buddhism that are as wide-ranging as, you know, the Catholic Church and the Mormon Church, or, you know, Luther. And so there are Buddhists in Asia who look at those they're not Buddhist. So in your description, beautiful description, you're kind of accepting it all as Buddhism. Any permutation, any development as it goes into a different culture. And I'm taking devil's advocate with you, but there are certain people who simply wouldn't accept what you said.
Well, I'm not sure I was quite as ecumenical as you described. I was saying that Buddhism has always been very dynamic and changing and adopting to the cultures it is in.
Right.
And it's not just because it adopted to Thailand before it came to America doesn't make that more or less a valid form of Buddhism in my mind per se. Okay.
Maybe.
I can't say for other people and other cultures how you should judge the organization, but I think individually we're all trying to, you know, to do it and to understand by doing it.
So traditional Buddhists like Tanjef, traditional sense of being rooted in Theravadan Buddhism, which is one of the most conservative surviving schools of Buddhism, and someone who's deeply grounded in the teachings of the historical Buddha, is interested in the radical possibility of nirvana, of uprooting all suffering in the human psyche, being totally free of suffering, being released. And then they go to Japan, and they hear this teaching that now, that was a fine teaching in the time of the Buddha, but we live in the period of the degenerate age. And it's not possible anymore in the degenerate age for anyone to really practice and have any real attainments. It's not possible anymore. You can't really meditate and get any kind of progress in meditation. It's not possible in this degenerate age. And therefore, the only thing that we can do is to chant the name of Amida Buddha and hope that when we die, we get reborn in the heavenly realm of Amida Buddha, where we can have a little bit more hope for some kind of progress. Now, someone who really believes it's possible in this lifetime to sit and meditate and practice and attain the full release of suffering, to hear that there's a Buddhist teaching that now says it's not possible at all, and what you should instead do is chant this name of this Buddha that you've never heard of before in your life and hope to get reborn in his Pure Land, that's going to seem really odd. And so the interesting question is, which I'm not going to answer. I don't feel like I don't want to answer, or I have a very ecumenical answer, is who is to decide who are Buddhists? There's no one who can decide that. So I'm inclined to accept anybody who says they're Buddhist as being Buddhist. That's fine with me. So that's kind of the direction I think you're pointing towards. If Buddhism adapts to a new culture, it's supposed to adapt. It's fine to adapt. But it's possible that as it adapts, something gets lost. And what Tanjef is concerned about is that for him, from his point of view, the core emphasis on nirvana is lost. So if he hears Western Buddhists talk about a wonderful kind of fuzzy feeling of interconnectedness as being the end goal of Buddhist practice, and it kind of feels good to feel interconnected, he feels frustrated because you're shortchanging yourself. He actually told me privately, he thinks that's a fine experience to have. It's not like he's critical of that experience. It's a fine, valid experience in and of itself. But he doesn't want people to stop there. And if the teachers are saying that's the goal, then people don't know any better that they can practice further beyond that. So that's his frustration, I think. That's just, you know, that's just a little bit shy to speak for him here. Rainbow.
I realized after you began describing it that I didn't remember it because I wasn't here last week. I was in San Francisco hearing a discussion with Gary Snyder and Peter Matheson talking with Peter Perry. And I sort of, it feels ironic to me that what they were talking about was interconnectedness. Yeah. And that when I listen to your description, I feel just delighted for your synopsis. I want to thank you for that. And that I guess it has always seemed to me that while interconnectedness feels like a good thing, and that my heart opens when I think about it, I don't think and I don't feel that that is the end of practice. It is a means to see an opening and a place to experience and practice compassion.
Beautiful. Thank you.
Just a couple of observations. I think that when you live in an individualistically oriented society, the tendency is to look for connectivity. I mean, we just sort of naturally get pushed there, as you were saying. I think the difficulty we have is that it's very hard for us to really reach the point where we can continue to develop skillful views. I think that Buddhism is really based on interconnectedness in the sense that karma is interconnectedness. And that's the whole basis for the view. The problem is that we become so attached to the view that it's very difficult to let go of it and move beyond it, as you were saying. I think it would be very difficult to separate interconnectedness from Buddhism, but I think it would be a mistake to recognize it as an endpoint or in a sense a final target in Buddhist practice.
I think it's a very good point. I think it also points to that the word interconnectedness can have a broad set of meanings for people who listen to it. And it could easily be seen as being, you know, karma is involves a certain kind of interconnectedness. There's a lot of things that are, you know, involve interconnectedness. So we have to define our terms to really understand what we're talking about. But if you take karma as being the, you know, the same thing as interconnectedness, then the Buddha didn't talk about interconnectedness specifically using those words. But I think that it's valid to say that if you read the discourses of the Buddha, interconnectedness is not the glorious goal and solution, or the you know, it's the problem. It's the problem that Buddhism is trying to address and to free us from. It's trying to free us from interconnectedness because for the Buddha, interconnectedness has an oppressive quality to it.
Mindlessness part is very heavily emphasized. So I think, you know, all religions get packaged to be culturally acceptable. So here, interconnectedness is emphasized, whereas in, let's say, where I come from, anatta, or the lack of I-ness, is emphasized. And so there's a whole lot of ritual around humility to eliminate the concern about the I. So that's a big contrast that I see in the two forms of Buddhism.
Beautiful, but that wasn't offensive, not to my ears. Yes, please.
When you said the speaker last week thinks the final goal is nirvana, so does that mean like a literal permanent enlightenment state?
Literal what?
Permanent enlightenment state that one would reach in this life actually.
The terms you use are a little bit problematic, but in basically yes, you'd agree.
It seems to me that nirvana in this lifetime and the idea is more of something that I view as a metaphor, as I view interconnectedness. And perhaps the feeling of interconnectedness is the closest we can get to something that is not speakable through language.
That's an interesting point. I speaking for Tan Jeff, I'm very confident he would not see nirvana as a metaphor. And I also don't see it as a metaphor. I see it as a kind of an experience. I see it as a real possibility for us that. So that's for me. The whole trust of Theravadan Buddhism is to lead a person to the experience of Nibbana, and rather than just being kind of a metaphorical carrot that keeps you going, I see it as a real possibility that is attainable. Is that done? Then? Yeah.
If you agree with or find what Tanjev said to be attractive, which I do, what implications does that have for our practice, given the fact that we're kind of enmeshed in so many other ways of presenting and thinking and teaching and practicing Buddhism?
So what are the implications for us with his teachings? I think one of the implications is to be very careful that our views don't trip us up, or our views don't inhibit our practice, and slow, kind of where we feel like, I've arrived, this is it. That we settle for some lesser nirvana. I mean, someone can have, there are great mystical experiences, great states of consciousness that are attainable, that come with a very strong sense of being interconnected. One feeling of being one with the world and others is a very powerful mystical state that some people experience. And it gets very compelling. Some of these mystical states, meditative states, are very, very compelling, with very kind of compelling interpretations that are almost built into them. And one of the implications is it's fine to have those. They can be helpful along the path, but don't settle for it. Don't say, oh, I got, that's it, you know, and say, now I've reached the end. There's lots of stories of people who think they've attained liberation or nirvana, but they've actually not really gotten that far yet. And so so now the comforting aspect of feeling interconnected, you know, is maybe appreciated by the person who will continue their practice beyond that. Yes, Ken.
The one thing I wrote down that he said, which may have been the only thing I heard that he said, a truly mature person is one who doesn't have to have certainty all the time. That means we can be liberated from the idea that it is this, or it is this, or it is this. And I sort of have a sense of Buddha having said, do it if it works for you. Don't take my word for it, don't take the teacher's word for it, don't take the scripture's word for it, do it if it works for you. So we don't have to know, oh, this is the practice of Buddhism, and oh, it's distorted in the West. Or no, it's not distorted in the West. Yeah. To me, it's a walk towards the end of suffering. It's that simple. So whether or not, you know, it's all this or that categories of things that we've sort of packaged it into tonight, that doesn't lead me down the road in my practice.
So you hear that? So... I think it was, so some of the things he said was a little bit confusing last week, I think. And one of these was this very point here, in that Ken remembers him saying, you know, a mature person can live with uncertainty. And I think he was actually quoting the Romantics.
Maslow.
I think it starts with the Romantics. I had conversations with him too. But then it started with the Romantics, that idea, and then it built from there onto others, Jung and maybe Maslow. But I think there can't be any freedom without some acceptance of uncertainty. Because where are you going to get certainty about everything? So last one, and then we should stop because we're over time.
I know there's a question. I got very torn up around the goal of the
achieving the goal and got very striving for that. So I can see some wisdom about not introducing the goal, or if you do, putting it in, a lot of wisdom about not striving and making a kind of torturing one to get somewhere. And yet, I was delighted by the clarity of being in another culture that wasn't afraid to say things that we've become somewhat afraid to say in our own culture. If you want to represent, say, a traditional Theravada teaching, to talk about goals could really ruin your day. It might end your life.
Oh, that's great. It's just beautiful. That's great, Temple. And the there was a sense of the people in Burma not being afraid to say it as they saw it. And some of it is because they were very direct and good teachers, and some of it is because they were fundamentalists. That's what fundamentalists tend to do anyway, right? And this is the way it is. And sometimes it worked really well for people, and for some Westerners it was a disaster. And they had some of those teachers had the wisdom to be direct at times, but they didn't have the wisdom to match the student sometimes. And some students got into big trouble in Asia practicing with teachers like that. And here in the West, one of the flavors of the American Vipassana movement is a real attempt to try to meet the student as a student is, and not to overlay a particular kind of idea of the path, but really meet the student where the student is at and try to kind of tailor make the path so it works for them, so they can follow their way. And so because of that, the flavor of the Vipassana teachers' teachings in America, the public ones tend to be some people would say it's to talk to the common denominator, but it's kind of like it's giving those kind of teachings that's going to work for the general American audience, because that's who's in the audience. And then when you meet with a teacher one-on-one, then you might get the practice tailor-made in a very different direction. And you might go to a Vipassana teacher, one day you go to a Vipassana teacher and the teacher says, practice goallessness. That's really where it's at. And the next day you go to a different teacher in the next retreat, and the teacher, tunes into what's right for you that particular retreat. And the teacher says, go for it. So how do we accommodate the individual psychologies of different people is a very important issue in practice. So are we distorting Buddhism in the West, or are we adapting it for the needs of the particular audience? And I think it's very hard to actually, make it clean either way, the decision what's what. But I hope this evening has made you a little more sensitive to some of these issues, and that when you hear American teachings and also Asian teachings, that because I could do, talks on those too, and the problems there. That the important thing for me is that you engage yourself in whatever you hear, and you don't just accept it because it sounds good and feels good, or because you have respect for the person sitting up here, but you really kind of take to task what you're hearing and engage yourself with it and think about it and try to understand what's really being said and try to understand maybe even sometimes the logic. Notice when a speaker is speaking, when they make a declarative statement. And if they make a declarative statement, you notice that. Notice what a declarative statement is. And then notice how the rest of their teaching follows from that declarative statement. But the assumptions behind the declarative statement have never been looked at. That's very important. So it's fun. I hope this has been useful. If this is just confusing for you or discouraging, then maybe that's good. I feel like we've raised more questions and concerns than we've settled tonight, and there's a whole range of them. And if any of you find some of them are still active and interesting for you, and then over the weeks and months we can address some of them, or you can talk to me directly, because some of the things I've said this evening could raise concerns, worries, maybe it makes you feel a little bit alienated even from the very tradition you're sitting in, and that's not the intention. So my intention is to have a community here where we can all be quite straightforward with each other and talk about even what we don't like about us ourselves, and what you don't like about me, or the teachings I give, for example, that we all kind of, that the communication flows freely. We can kind of talk about the, you know, what doesn't work and what does work, rather than someone leaving because something doesn't seem comfortable. Let's duke it out. So thank you.